Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to Where is Riley Brennan? The Shelby Oaks Companion Podcast. Shelby Oaks releases in cinemas in South Africa on Friday, the 24th of October. I had the great pleasure, along with several lucky True Crime South Africa listeners, of attending the pre-screening event. So I can tell you ahead of you watching it that it is an incredible film and perfect for both fans of the horror genre and true crime. It is, of course, the perfect month for this movie to be dropping, with Halloween coming up, and the horror element of the movie is undoubtedly intense. But it also contains some really important real-world themes, which deserve deeper exploration. Hence, this companion podcast. Shelby Oaks is the story of two sisters, Mia and Riley Brennan. Riley has been missing for 12 years, and Mia has become obsessed with solving her sister's case and finding her, because Mia refuses to believe that her sister is dead. After 12 years, and given certain circumstances around her disappearance, almost everyone around Mia has come to terms with the fact that Riley is probably not coming home. But Mia lives in the ambiguous lost state that so many families of the missing do, where if she gives up hope, she feels like she's letting her sister down. And without a body, it's incredibly difficult to accept that someone you love is never coming home. The movie recounts Mia's quest to find her sister, or at the very least, find the truth, which takes her deep into the clutches of an unknown evil. The film's director, Chris Stuckman, developed the idea for the movie with his wife many years before it was made. And he says he realized during the production process that it was actually deeply personal to him because of a different kind of ambiguous loss he had experienced when he was a child. Stuckman's family had been part of a religion which uses excommunication when members do not comply with the ideology. This means that a person being excommunicated is exiled, both from the group and the family, and their family members and friends who remain in the group are not allowed to have any contact with the excommunicated person. Essentially, that person is dead to them, although they are still very much alive, just living somewhere else. Stuckman's sister was excommunicated from the group and the family when he was 12 years old, and he came to realize how that experience was similar in many ways to what the character Mia Brennan, played by Camille Sullivan, would be experiencing. This companion podcast episode is not going to contain any spoilers, but if you're listening to this and weren't one of the lucky winners who got to watch the pre-screening, I do highly recommend you pause now and go and book your tickets to see Shelby Oaks as soon as possible. It truly is an excellent film and explores so many of the elements you as true crime fans will be familiar with. This movie comes out around a time when I'm revisiting a lot of the real pain and trauma that families of the missing experience. I recently released my fourth book, Bare Bones, which is about 10 of the unsolved cases I've covered on the podcast, and the leads and new developments on those cases since I published the episodes. As part of the research for that book, I went back to each of the families and had new conversations with them about where they are now. In many cases, it's anywhere between 3 and 6 years since I covered their loved ones' cases, and I'm always struck by how deep the grief remains. In the cases of the murdered, the grief of losing their loved one to violent crime is often amplified and made more complicated when the case remains unsolved and no one is made to stand to account for that loss. In the cases of the missing, though, that grief and sense of loss is even more layered and complex. You heard me use the term ambiguous loss or ambiguous grief in the beginning of this episode. That term used to be something that was used more colloquially to try to explain this weird state that people who have missing loved ones find themselves in. But today it's become widely accepted within the mental health care community as a formal way to describe this emotional experience. There's even been formal research conducted around ambiguous loss and its effects on individuals and families and communities. One of these research reports defines ambiguous loss as, quote, an unclear loss with no official verification of life or death, and thus no closure. It occurs when a person is missing with no clarity about his or her absence or presence. Ambiguous loss is the most stressful type of loss because there is no proof of finality. End quote. The report goes on to describe two types of ambiguous loss, physical and psychological. Physical ambiguous loss occurs when a person is physically absent, but kept psychologically present because their status as dead or alive remains unclear, like the kind of loss Mia Brennan would have been living with for 12 years, having no idea where Riley is. When there's no proof of death, remaining family members are understandably confused and, predictably, disagree on the fate of their missing loved one. Some continue to hope for return, others perceive the lost person as clearly dead. And of course, people disappear in a wide variety of circumstances. People who go missing in war actually account for a large number of the world's missing, as do those who go missing after natural disasters. Without some physical proof, DNA evidence, or a body to bury, the family's loss becomes a story with no ending. The second type of ambiguous loss is psychological. This occurs when a person is physically present, but absent psychologically, due to some cognitive or emotional impairment, like dementia, from disease or brain injury, addictions, chronic mental illness, and, interestingly, even those suffering from frozen grief. And I think this scenario is so interesting, and of course, tragic, because essentially what happens is when there's a loss, whether it's death or the ambiguous loss of someone going missing, a family member can become so obsessed with that loss that they are no longer available as a loved one to others. And those around them essentially experience an ambiguous loss of their own, because that person is still there physically, but cognitively and emotionally, they are no longer the person they once were. And I think as far as Shelby Oaks is concerned, that's really what those around Mia would have been experiencing too. On the day Riley went missing, the person Mia was also went away, and she was replaced by an obsessed sister, searching for the truth. So while those around her may not have experienced an ambiguous loss around Riley's disappearance, because they accepted she was likely dead, they did experience those complicated emotions around Mia, because the woman they'd known was no longer available to them. Mia's relationship with her husband clearly suffered deeply as a result of Riley going missing, and it becomes obvious that he thinks his wife is having a break from reality and needs psychological help. I think the director, Chris Stuckman's experience with his sister having been excommunicated sort of fits into both of these types of ambiguous loss, although she really was physically missing from their family. They were required by the group to act as though she was dead. The family did sort of know where she was, in as much as they knew she was living in the world outside of their religious group, but they had absolutely no knowledge of her life, So she very well could have been ill or even passed away without them knowing. When I started doing this work and engaging with families who were dealing with loss through murder and loss by virtue of the loved one being missing, it took me a long time to figure out which of these types of grief is worse. What I've come to understand is that neither is worse or better. They're just really different. Those who have had murdered loved ones do say that they cannot imagine not knowing where their loved ones are, but also wonder what it's like to still have that shred of hope. On the other hand, those who have missing loved ones can't imagine knowing that their person is definitely dead, but also understand that at least it would be an answer. Many, like Mia, cannot bring themselves to accept that without physical proof, and therefore continue to hold on to the hope that they are alive until they're proven wrong. But that in itself comes with its own set of difficulties. From a societal perspective, those with murdered loved ones tend to get a lot more support from their community and police than the missing. When your loved one is confirmed as dead, there are supportive rituals and traditions that can be undertaken, which often help with the grieving process. But when the person is missing, you have none of that. I've witnessed firsthand how the family of the missing live on an ongoing rollercoaster ride of emotions, and how much damage that can do in the long term if it's not carefully managed. One family I've worked with who has had their sister and daughter, Desiree Reed, missing for 25 years now, has experienced ambiguous loss and all its effects firsthand. Like Mia in Shelby Oaks, Janet Zhao has spent every single day since her sister went missing, wondering where she has gone and what happened to her. As she explained to me, as the years went by, the amount of physical and mental effort she was able to put into actually searching for her sister would ebb and flow. And she learned early on that she had to let it if she wanted to have any semblance of a life outside of the search. Janet has, while still searching for her sister, managed to raise a family with her husband, and her children, although never having met their aunt, are also touched by the ambiguous loss that has become a fixture in their family. The ripples that have come off their mother and grandmother around Desiree's ambiguous loss have impacted their lives as much as their parents try to limit that. Both are now leaving school and going into careers that involve caring or service to others, nursing and forensic pathology, both in the hope that one day they will come across someone like their missing aunt and be able to help another family to not experience what they have. This, of course, is an example of a positive result of ambiguous loss. But that is a direct result of Janet and her family working hard to try and balance the ongoing search for Desiree with some type of normality, albeit never the normality they once knew. Other families I've spoken with have had to stretch out the periods between which they actively search in much larger gaps, and some have chosen to stop looking altogether, leaving the search to the authorities, simply to retain their own sanity. So many now live with mental and physical health conditions they didn't have before their loved ones disappeared, undoubtedly brought on by the stress and strain of ambiguous loss. I've sadly also seen families torn apart by one of their members going missing. Sometimes, especially when it's a child who's gone missing, the parents each have different ways of dealing with the ambiguous loss. One parent may want to hang on to the hope and continue searching in every way possible, while the other may prefer to accept that the child is dead and try to move forward with that reality. It is very difficult, if not impossible, to have those two ways of thinking coexist in the same relationship, and very often couples will divorce in the wake of a child going missing if they remain missing for some time. Along with the emotional consequences of having a missing family member, there are also legal and financial consequences, which I don't think many people think about. Vicky Derrick has lived in this reality for 8 years, while her husband, Vincent, has been missing. Because her husband is just gone and there's no body, there is of course no death certificate. And while all countries do have a time period after which you can declare someone dead, that also comes along with the emotional toll of accepting they're dead. If you don't do this, however, like this particular wife, you end up dealing with a whole lot of consequences you never imagined. She said, quote, "My husband has been missing for 8 years. We still have a mortgage that has not been resolved, which is in joint names. I can't change that mortgage. I can't move house. I haven't been able to do anything for the past 8 years. It has been extremely difficult. I have gone from having a joint income of a husband who earned far more than I earned to being a single mum overnight on a greatly reduced income." End quote. And think about that from the financial perspective too. If your missing loved one was a breadwinner in your home, there might well be policies that could pay out. But that will only happen if they're declared dead. And even then, some policies will not pay out based on the fact that they don't know how the policyholder died. So you're just left in limbo in every possible way. Another aspect that I've discovered to be a huge issue among families of the missing is access to resources to navigate this very strange world. There's no guidebook that tells you what to do if your family member goes missing, and there's so much misinformation out there that can do a lot of damage to cases. In my book, Bare Bones, I provide a hopefully easy-to-follow guide of what you should do in the first 24 hours when your loved one goes missing, in terms of interacting with the police. But even if families are able to get that part right, there's still so much more that goes into having a missing family member that resources don't exist in most places to support. Often just being able to speak to another family who's had someone go missing is extremely helpful, because they, of all people, really do get it. This deep need for community among the families of the missing has been something that family members have tried to use to bring some sense of meaning to their own journeys by starting organizations and campaigning for legislative change in their home countries. By doing so, their own ambiguous loss is somewhat mitigated, in that they feel like the terrible pain they experience is making some difference, and perhaps preventing others from experiencing the same in the future. In South Africa, two of our biggest missing person advocacy organizations were started as a result of several cases of missing children, and those being involved in the cases recognizing that there was something deeply lacking in the way families were treated and how law enforcement managed the cases. Both the Pink Ladies and Missing Children South Africa were started in 2007 and are now two of the most well-known missing person advocacy organizations in the country. Their formation resulted from the cases of two girls in 2007. Sheldene Human was 7 years old when she was abducted and murdered in Tshwane, and the second, 11-year-old Anastasia Visa, was also abducted and murdered in the Western Cape. The investigation into the missing persons leg of both cases were found deeply wanting in the aftermath of their bodies being discovered, and the families in both cases were let down badly by a seeming lack of focused attention. Both organisations now play an important role in connecting families of the missing with support in the early hours of their loved ones disappearing. And there are similar examples of this type of advocacy and change being sparked by the pain of ambiguous loss across the world. In 1979, 6-year-old Adam Walsh was abducted from a shopping centre. He was found deceased 2 weeks later. And his father, John Walsh, went on to create the National Centre for Missing and Exploited Children, as well as hosting several television programs related to crime, including America's Most Wanted. The Amber Alert system, which is now used in various forms in several countries across the world to create immediate alerts to the public when a minor goes missing, with the Amber in that name referring to the child whose missing persons case resulted in the alert being created. Amber Hagerman was a 9-year-old American girl who was abducted and eventually found murdered in 1996. Sadly, Amber's case remains unsolved to this day. But her legacy lives on, not just in the Amber Alert system, which has saved so many children since its inception, but also legislatively, as advocacy work by her parents, as well as another father of a missing child, Polly Klaas, resulted in Bill Clinton, during his presidency, signing a law into effect which created a publicly available sex offenders register in the US. This register helps parents to protect their children by knowing how many registered sex offenders live in their neighbourhood. In the UK, the disappearance and murder of 8-year-old Sarah Payne in 2000 resulted in her parents campaigning for legislative change, which was eventually passed. The legislation, called Sarah's Law, makes it mandatory for police to disclose if an individual has a history of sex offences if an inquiry is made by a member of the public. Back in South Africa, the case of Zephanie Nurse, who was abducted from a hospital just hours after she was born and only reunited with her family as a teenager, also contributed to a wide range of changes and advocacy. Hospitals across the country tightened up their security in maternity wards, and this case is one of the main reasons that maternity wards are so well locked down to this day. Later, after Zephanie was found to be living with the woman who had abducted her, and she discovered that she was in fact a missing person, she joined campaigns to have the names of minor victims of crime protected, even after they turn 18. Zephanie said that it was unfair to minor victims of crime to have their names forever linked to the circumstances outside of their control. And unless the individual chose to make their own name known, they should be granted legal anonymity. In 2019, amendments were made to the Child Justice Act, which grants anonymity to both minor victims of violent crime as well as minor perpetrators, even after they turn 18. Disappearances look different across the board, and a large number of historical missing persons cases in South Africa are as a result of apartheid government activities during predominantly the 60s, 70s and 80s. Many people around that time who stood against the apartheid government disappeared and are believed to have been murdered, but their remains have never been recovered. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or TRC, which occurred after the official fall of apartheid in the mid-90s, did help to bring some resolution to a few families, but far too many of these cases remain unsolved. As a result of this, a specialised unit called the Missing Persons Task Team, or MPTT, was formed to specifically investigate these cases. Even when individuals are not starting their own organisations or campaigning for legislative change, Many family members of the missing find solace in providing either advice or just a sounding board for other families. An organisation in the UK called Missing People offers a program through which those who have experienced ambiguous loss can mentor and provide assistance to families who've just entered the world of the missing. While missing children often get a lot of attention from both the public and law enforcement, missing adults can often slip under the radar, and the official search for the truth of their whereabouts often wanes far sooner than in cases involving minors, if there was any official effort to begin with. This is incredibly distressing to families, for whom these missing loved ones are just as important as any missing minor. There are, of course, reasons why adult missing person cases often receive less attention. For one, it's not a crime to go missing as an adult. If you're over 18 and don't have an active warrant out on you and haven't tried to fake your death, which is a crime, you can disappear of your own accord, and it's not illegal to do so. And although planned disappearances to start a new life somewhere else do happen, they're actually really uncommon. And what is more common is that the individual is at risk in some way and does need some form of assistance. The type of risk varies, though. And this is one of the reasons law enforcement across the world are notorious for not rushing in, guns blazing, when an adult disappears. This phenomenon is only made worse when the missing person has what some might term a high-risk lifestyle. Time and again, I've seen cases involving missing people with diagnosed mental health conditions, substance use disorders, or involvement in sex work receive far less attention, both from the police and the public. The minute any of these so-called high-risk behaviours is linked to the person, interest goes way down. Where the public is concerned, it's almost like society expects individuals with these lifestyles to have something bad happen to them. And when it does, perhaps for many, it feels like putting their own energy into searching would be fruitless. For police, their stats tell them that individuals with high-risk characteristics often return on their own at some point. And families will be told they've probably gone off on a binge and will come back when they're finished. Families with missing loved ones involved in the sex trade are often told that they've probably just gone off to work another area or gone on a trip away with a client. Sometimes these assumptions are accurate. But the lack of investigation in the key early days of the person going missing also results in many who have not gone down those expected roads never being found at all. And it's not just the more obvious high-risk characteristics that result in families not getting the help they need for the missing. Families from marginalised communities and those who live in lower socioeconomic areas also experience a lack of assistance. Every country across the world that has an indigenous group of people who have historically experienced being oppressed and marginalised shows the exact same trend. Men, women and children from those communities do not receive the same level of assistance that others do. And the press plays a role in all of this. While they're certainly not solely to blame as such, the stories the mainstream media choose to amplify do impact the attention all cases receive. But this comes full circle, in that the media cover what will be consumed. So if we, as the reading, listening, or watching public, aren't showing an interest in missing person cases where the individual has a high-risk lifestyle or is from a marginalised community, then the press have zero motivation to show those cases to us. In Shelby Oaks, Mia's experience with the police and public perception around her sister's case was quite unique because her sister was a relatively public figure and the circumstances around her disappearance meant that the police had no choice but to immediately get involved. I'm trying really hard not to give any spoilers here. But we did see that police involvement became really limited and the police seemed to be waiting for leads to find them rather than the other way around. As far as the public perception around Riley's case, that's also quite a unique situation. Again, because of what Riley did for a living and her public persona. This has meant that Mia has a lot of awareness about her sister's case. But in many ways, that's actually been more damaging than beneficial, as we see in the film. And there are real-world examples of this too. In 2004, an American woman called Maura Murray disappeared after she was involved in a car accident. In the months and years after her disappearance, her case became the stuff of urban legend for many armchair detectives, and many wild theories were thrown around about what might have happened to her. Maura's sister, Julie, has never given up hope that she'll find her sister, one way or another. But in the last few years, Julie has come forward to share some of the details of how public attention to her sister's case has negatively affected the investigation and her family. Julie eventually ended up becoming a true crime podcaster herself, so that she could share Maura's story in a factual, non-sensationalist way. And she campaigns for other true crime content creators to do the same when they cover cases. Julie's experience, in some senses, has been quite severe. Not only has she continued to find misinformation about Maura online, but she's even had certain members of the true crime community verbally abusing her in public for her views around her sister's case. Another sister who's taken up true crime storytelling as a full-time gig in order to fight for justice for her missing sister is Sarah Turney, whose sister Alyssa went missing in 2001. The main suspect in her sister's case has always been their father, Michael Turney, and the case is so nuanced that Sarah could no longer sit back and let others talk about it online without her input. While I'm sure that there are many cases out there of brothers continuing to fight for justice for their missing siblings, there certainly seems to be something about the bond between sisters that turns left-behind siblings into powerhouse campaigners for their missing loved ones. It's a reality that makes the story behind Shelby Oaks incredibly relatable. You'll go into the movie with a question I pose in the title of this companion podcast. Where is Riley Brennan? And of course, you'll have to watch the film to find out whether or not that question is answered. But I think, even if it is, it leaves us with a deeper understanding of the greater tragedy that plays out across the world on a daily basis. Millions of families with no answers. The devastating impact of ambiguous loss on the lives of family and friends. How do you move on when there are no answers? When someone who was a daily part of your life just vanishes, seemingly disappearing into thin air, and the only trace left of them is a deep scar in your heart. Where are all the missing? Shelby Oaks opens in cinemas across South Africa on Friday, the 24th of October. It is a deeply personal story, told in a way that makes you wonder whether what you thought you knew about the world is really true. And I highly recommend you go out and watch it. A huge thanks to Shelby Oaks and Empire Entertainment for supporting the production of this companion podcast to the brand new release movie, Shelby Oaks.